So we're about to start. Okay. So we're going to start at May the 2nd, 1905. The three types of resurrection which suffering contains. Okay. As I continued to be in suffering a little more than usual on coming, my good Jesus told me, my daughter, suffering contains three types of resurrection. This is why you're being told it's so precious. Okay. First, suffering makes the soul rise again to grace. Second, as suffering advances, it gathers the virtues and the soul rises again to sanctity. Third, as suffering continues, it perfects the virtues, it embellishes them with splendor, forming a beautiful crown. And the soul crowned rises again to glory on earth and to glory in heaven. This is the incredible thing, that when we allow the cross to do its crafting within us, that it enables us to rise from sin, rise to sanctity, and rise to glory. Now, the glory on the earth is that God is able to live and reign and work in us in the divine will and do his work on earth. And then we rise to glory in heaven. So when he would explain that, we have to realize that that we must accept the cross much more than we would have done before. So May the 5th, 1905. The effects of grace. As I was in my usual state, Blessed Jesus came for just a little, and it seemed that another image completely similar to him would come out from his interior, only that it was smaller. I was surprised on seeing this, and he said to me, "My daughter, everything that can come out from within a person is called a birth." This is where you get the language of birthing the divine will and so on. "And this birth becomes the child of the one who gives birth to it. Now, this daughter of mine is grace." That's the second image she saw on line two. Okay? She saw an image of grace. "Coming out of me communicates herself to all the souls who want to receive her and transmutes them." Now, that's a very big word. That means to transform a character. Okay, to change the substance. Transmute means change the substance. "And transmutes them into many other children of mine." So grace transforms us into children of God. Okay? "Not only this, but everything good and virtuous that can come out of these second children comes from the children of grace." Now, you know from volumes 1-4 that grace is an outpouring of God himself, and that Jesus said, "I am grace." Okay, so this is an outpouring of God himself in us, enabling us to bring forth the spiritual children of all the virtues that are within. "See now what a long generation of children grace forms for herself, if only they received her. But how many reject her, and my daughter comes back into my womb alone and childless." While he was saying this, that image closed herself within me, filling me completely with herself. Therefore, Louisa is a daughter of grace. Can you see it? She's a child of grace. So, May the 9th, 1905. "The soul who is united to grace can do what death must do to her nature." This is very important. And this is going to explain why you shouldn't have to go through purgatory. So put an NB on this one, will you? "Continuing in my usual state, it seemed to me that my adorable Jesus was coming out from within my interior, and with sweet and affable voice he said, 'And why, my daughter, can the soul united to grace not do in advance everything that death must do to nature?' In other words, many people do as little as possible, and then the body is separated from the soul, and the poor soul has to go through all kinds of purification in purgatory. He says, "Why can't you do it now?" Okay. "That is, making it die in advance for love of God." And of course, you get all the merits that go with it. Making it die to everything to which it will have to die anyway. Okay? So in death, you've got to let everything go one way or the other. And the Lord says that if you really want to make huge advance in the divine will, let everything go now. Let it go now. Now, what do you mean by everything? Does that mean you have to get rid of your house? No. Your car? No. Your own opinion? Yes. Your own ego? Yes. Your own selfishness? Yes. All the things you're attached to. There's nothing wrong with this pen, but if I'm attached to it, the pen is now my enemy because of the attachment. Because St. John of the Cross says that if a bird is tied to a tree and cannot fly, it's a slave, isn't it? It's captured. But it's a much greater tragedy to be tied with a thread than a rope. And very often, good people are tied by a thread and not a rope. That pen is only a thread. Does that make sense? In other words, it isn't something major that's enslaving me. It's something minor. Okay. Something minor. So, but only those who dwell continuously with my grace come to have this blessed death, because by living with God, it is easier for them to die to everything that is fleeting. And as the soul lives with God and dies to all the rest, her very nature comes to anticipate the privileges which must enrich her in the resurrection. I want to give you two texts there. Matthew 10:39 and Matthew 16:25. Matthew 16:25. That is, letting go all this stuff, she will feel spiritualized, deified, and incorruptible. Now look at those three words. Really look at them. Really meditate on them. In addition to all the goods in which the soul will take part, feeling herself the partaker of all the privileges of divine life. That's 2 Peter 1:4. 2 Peter 1:4. In addition to this, there is the distinction of glory which these souls will have in heaven. They will be so different from the others as heaven is different from the earth. Okay? And having said this, he disappeared. I want to give you 1 John 3:6 for that. Now, he will tell you many more times as we go on in the volumes that the souls who live, genuinely live in the divine will, having let go of their own will and their own ego, and they live in their nothingness and they throw their nothingness into his allness, which gives him the freedom to move and to work with us, that those souls will be in a very special place in heaven. Very special. Okay. In fact, he says there will be 9 choirs of them. And depending on how much we live and operate the kingdom on earth, we'll decide which choir we're in. We won't all be seraphs. Some people will. And because they've chosen that place. Is that okay? So May the 12th, 1905, I have an NB on this one. The means not to lose the love of Jesus. As I was in my usual state, my blessed Jesus came for just a little. And on seeing him, I don't know why, I said to him, Lord, still, this is something that lacerates my soul, the thought that I might lose your love. Now, if you truly love somebody, the pain is that you could lose the person. Isn't that right? And he said, my daughter, who told you this? In all things, my paternal goodness has administered the means to help the creature as long as these means would not be rejected. So the means not to lose my love is to hold my love and everything that regards me as if it were your own. Okay. 1 Timothy 1:13. Speaks about the love which is in Christ Jesus. So you're to hold everything to do with him as if it was your own. Now, can one lose all that is his? Certainly not. At the most, he has no esteem for something that is his own, He will not have the care to keep it in a safe place. But if he has no esteem for it and does not keep it in a safe place, it's a sign that he doesn't love it. In other words, we look after what we esteem. Therefore, that object no longer contains the life of love and cannot be numbered among his own things. The things you really call your own are the things that you take care of and love and look after. Okay? But when one makes my love his own, he esteems it. He keeps it in a safe place. He always keeps an eye on it. We use that expression, don't we? In such a way that he cannot lose what is his either in life or in death. So I want to give you a few scriptures for that. 1 John 4:17. 1 John 4:17. Ephesians 5:2. And the letter of Jude, verse 21. There's only one chapter in it, as you know. So it's to make the love of Jesus our own. And if it is our own, we take care of it, look after it, and everything's fine. So May the 15th, 1905, the path of virtue is easy. Now, outside of the divine will and outside of loving God, it's extremely difficult. If you're only leaning on human nature, it's extremely difficult. But if you're in the divine will and your motivation is love for Jesus, then it's actually quite easy. Louisa said, continuing in my usual state, blessed Jesus came for a little and told me, my daughter, they say that the path to virtue is difficult. False. It's difficult for one who does not move, because knowing neither the graces nor the consolations she would receive from God, nor the help for her to move, it seems difficult for her. And without moving forward, you'd have to put in, she feels all the weight of the journey. But for one who moves, it's extremely easy, because the grace that inundates her fortifies her, and the beauty of the virtues attracts her. The divine spouse of souls carries her, cleaving to his arm, accompanying her all along the journey. I want to give you Acts 11:23. I should also give you another one which I didn't think of until this minute, and that's I think it's Exodus 19. It's around verse 24. I brought you on eagle's wings all the way to this place. Now, they thought they had dragged their heels all across the desert for 40 years. But he said, I brought you on eagle's wings. In other words, I worked miracle after miracle after miracle to get you here in spite of everything. And you're here in spite of all the odds. And nobody thought you'd get here, not even yourselves. Okay. That's Exodus 19. So in spite of all the opposition within us and outside of us, if we cling to the love of Jesus and to the divine will, we'll get there. Okay. And the soul, instead of feeling the weight and the difficulty of moving, wants to hasten her way in order to reach more quickly the end of the path and her very centre. That's Philippians 3:9-16. Philippians 3:9-16. There's Paul describing that he's on the road, and he wants to persevere, and he's running to claim the prize for which Christ Jesus captured him. In other words, he is deciding to move, that he is doing the movement that grace actually wants. Now, as we go along, the Lord will tell you that life is in the movement. When you see something on a bed that's absolutely not moving, the eyes are not moving, and the heart isn't moving, and the ears are not moving, and the hands are not moving, and you say, uh-oh. They finish the journey. But if you see a baby, everything is moving in the baby. Have you noticed? And the baby is in total motion all the time, because every part of that little being is growing. Okay. And spiritually, if we're stagnant inside, we've stopped. If we're moving and things are growing inside of us, then we're on the journey. It's just a little key, so that you can test where you're at, okay? So May the 18th, 1905, I have a VIP on this one. Continuing in my usual state, Blessed Jesus came for just a little and told me, my daughter, fear takes life away from love. Now, fear is a big, big enemy. Fear is one of the things that stops people from making any journey spiritually. And you need to know that fear is Satan's weapon. It's his biggest weapon. You'll know that all tyrants operate through fear, don't they? Okay. And anybody who wants to tyrannize you will also use all kinds of threats and everything to get you under their control. It's fear. I want to give you 1 John 4:18. Love casts out fear. Love casts out 1 John 4:18. Love casts out fear, and you face the day of judgment without fear. Okay, because God is love. And so if you die in this condition, love is meeting love. Okay? So continue in my usual state. Blessed Jesus came for just a little and told me, my daughter, fear takes life away from love. Not only this, but also the very virtues which do not originate from love decrease the life of love in the soul. Anything that just has purely human origin. On the contrary, in all things, love deserves preference. That's 1 Corinthians 14:1. You must want love more than anything else. Because love makes everything easy. And Ephesians 3:16-21. That's Paul saying that you must be grounded in love, built on love, reach your fullness in love until you reach the fullness of Christ. Okay, so love has to have the preference. And the reason is that God is love, 1 John 4:7. So while the very virtues which do not originate from love are like many victims that end up in the slaughter, that is, in the destruction of the virtues themselves. Okay. Now, many times Jesus comes back to this point, and that is that the summary of the 36 volumes is divine will and love. Okay. So they're the two things you have to be concentrating on. And if we're not growing in love, we're not growing in divine will. Because the divine will is the operating part of God, and God is love. That's his nature. So we can always test how we're doing. So May the 20th, 1905, the way of suffering of Jesus. This morning I was thinking of when Blessed Jesus remained all dislocated on the cross, and I said to myself, ah, Lord, how tormented you must have been by suffering so atrocious, and how afflicted your soul must have been. Okay. At that moment, almost like a shadow, he came and he said, daughter, I did not occupy myself with my sufferings. Do you see what she said? How afflicted you must have been in your soul because of these external sufferings. His answer was, absolutely no. Somebody who has conquered the cross lets the cross do its work. But that's not where your attention is. Your attention is on what you're doing through the cross for God and for humanity. That's terribly important. And he said, I did not occupy myself with my sufferings, but rather I occupied myself with the purpose of my pains. So beside that, I want you to put Hebrews 12:2. And that says that for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame. You're not asked to enjoy suffering. Nobody enjoys suffering. It's completely abhorrent to human nature. But if you know you can do something with it, you turn it into what in higher volumes will be called divine currency. Okay, so that you can actually save souls with this suffering. And therefore, because it is useful and you can do something important with it, then you will put up with it. Okay. I occupied myself with the purpose of my pains, and since in my pains I could see the will of the Father fulfilled, I suffered, and in my very suffering I found the sweetest rest. Now, that sweetest rest is that there's no disturbance inside of you. There's no conflict going on inside of you. She said you must have been suffering in your soul, which would mean conflict. But you know that in the gospel, at the end of the agony in the garden, Jesus said it's all over. There will be no more agonizing. Because he had to bring his entire self to agree with something that was utterly disagreeable to him. And you only in Louise's writings actually find the reason why he was agonizing. And that is that the Father showed him that some people would not be saved no matter what he did. And that was the bit he couldn't take. And if he explains to Louise as she goes along as well, that if she's going to be one with the divine will, she's got to agree with everything that the divine will wants, whether that is chastisement for the human race or whether it's the salvation of souls or the glory of God or whatever it is. You've got to agree with everything. They've got to become one will. And so he had to become one with the Father, even though he was about to pay the highest price for our redemption, that to agree that souls were still free and they could say no and they could end up in hell. And of course, Louisa says this as well, that the biggest problem for Jesus was that his friend Judas was going down. And it was his friend, you know. So it was a horrifying thing for him, who was love itself, love incarnate. Okay. So in my pains, I could see the will of the Father being fulfilled. I suffered, and in my suffering, I found the sweetest rest. In fact, doing the will of God contains this good. Now, all of you will find this if you've struggled to get into the divine will on any particular subject, that when you're there, you have the most extraordinary experience in the depths of your being that can be called not just rest, but sweet rest. It's extraordinary, and it's a reward in itself. While if you're fighting against God's will, you have this disturbance inside of yourself, which adds to your problems. So while one suffers, one finds the most beautiful rest. But if one enjoys, but this enjoyment is not wanted by God, in the very enjoyment one finds the atrocious torment. That means people who go for illicit pleasures, whatever they are, that are totally against God's will, while they might have some physical satisfaction at the moment, they have the atrocious problem of a conscience that is very disturbed. Okay. Unless the conscience dies, and then that's a real problem. Even more, the closer I would come to the end of the pains, yearning to fulfill the will of the Father in everything, the more relieved I would feel and my rest would become more beautiful. And yet the amazing thing is that when you follow the passion of Jesus, I mean, he died in atrocious agony. And yet he can say in the depths of his being, the peace went deeper and deeper. Hence his final words, I've done it. I've done it. It's accomplished. And that it's accomplished thing is very often not understood. It's the same as the Olympic gold winner saying, I made it, I did it. Doesn't matter what the cost was. And so it's that's a cry of triumph from Jesus. Okay. So how different it is the way of souls. If they suffer or operate or work, we would say, their gaze is neither on the fruit which they can obtain, nor on the fulfillment of the divine will. So we put our attention on the wrong things. We either put our attention on the labour of the work or the conditions of the work, and we don't put our attention on, I'm doing this for that reason. Now, parents can manage this better than the rest of us, because I am labouring to get money to put my son or my daughter into university. I know what I'm at. So while I'm tired and I'm doing too much and I should be resting and I should be taking time off, I want my kid to get into the university, so I pay this price. So parents get there much quicker than the rest of us, okay? And that is to keep your eyes on the goal. So they concentrate on themselves or on the thing that they're doing and not seeing the goods which they can earn or the sweet rest that God, the will of God brings. They live bothered and tormented in soul, understood, and they shun suffering and working as much as they can, thinking of finding rest, that means relief. But they remain more tormented than before. So outside of the divine will, no rest. Inside of the divine will, rest. Now, beside that, I want you to put Psalm 62. Psalm 62 says, rest in God, my soul. From him comes my strength. And it repeats it at least three times. Okay, rest in God, my soul. So, May the 23rd, 1905. In order not to feel disturbance, the soul must found herself well in God. We would say, establish yourself well in God. This morning I found myself outside of myself, Louisa said, and I felt someone in my arms with his head leaning on my shoulder. I could not manage to see who he was, so I pulled him by force, saying to him, tell me at least who you are. And he said, I am the all. And on hearing him say he was the all, I said, and I am the nothing. This is one of the big things in divine will. He's everything and I'm nothing. And we throw our nothingness into his allness and everything's fine. See, Lord, how right I am that this nothing must remain united with the all. That's Psalm 90. If you dwell in the shelter of the Most High, he will take care of everything. Otherwise, it would be like a handful of dust which the wind scatters away. In the meantime, I saw someone who was doubtful and was saying, how is it that for the every slightest thing one feels so much disturbance? And I, through a light that's infused knowledge that came from blessed Jesus, said, in order not to feel disturbance, the soul must found herself well in God, or we would say establish herself well in God, tend to God with all of herself as though to one single point, and look at all the other things with indifferent eyes. Now, in our modern language, we have put that down in three words, all for Jesus, or four words, all eyes on Jesus. If you have your attention, if you have your compass fixed, you'll get there. But if she's otherwise, in everything she does, sees or hears, she will feel her soul invested with a disquiet, like those slow fevers that make the soul all worn out, disturbed, unable herself to make head or tail of anything. Have you any idea what a name for a slow fever might be? The fever you get from the mosquito bite is very slow and devastates you over a period of years. They probably had mosquitoes. Okay. I'm only suggesting that it's the only really slow one I know. That doesn't mean there aren't others. So May the 25th, 1905, the image of Jesus in the soul. As I was in my usual state, I could see blessed Jesus outside and inside my interior. There's somebody well established in God. Okay, he's outside and inside. If I would see him as a child outside, as a child, I would see him inside. If I would see him crucified outside, it would be the same inside. I remained surprised, and he said to me, my daughter, when my image is formed completely, notice the word completely, that's 100%, in the interior of the soul, whatever form I want to assume externally in order to look at myself, the same one is assumed by my image, which I have formed in the soul. What is the wonder then? So I want to give you two texts there. Romans 8:29, we're formed in the image of the Son. And John 14:20-21, you in me and I in you. So May the 26th, 1905, When the soul is all of Jesus, she feels her murmuring within his being. Now notice she feels her murmuring within his being. As I was outside of myself, Louisa said, I found myself with baby Jesus in my arms, and I said to him, my pretty little one, I am all and always yours. Oh, please do not permit anything to flow within me, be it even a shadow which is not yours. Now, that's the commitment that's required of all of us, that we give ourselves 100%. And it's only at that point that you get all the benefits. And he said, my daughter, when a soul is all mine, I feel a continuous murmuring of her being within me. John 15:9, as the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. I feel this continuing murmuring of hers flow in my voice, in my heart, in my mind, in my hands, in my steps, and even in my blood. Oh, how sweet is this murmuring of hers. He's trying to give her an image of two in one. And I suppose a woman can have that image in a child in her womb. And the child murmuring and moving and everything in the womb. Oh, how sweet is this murmuring of hers in me. And as I feel it, I keep repeating, everything, everything, everything of this soul is mine. That means she's already reached paradise. If everything in her is his. And that means if she dies at that moment, she goes straight to heaven. And I love you so much. And I seal the murmuring of my love in her. So just as I feel hers, the soul feels my murmuring in all of her being. So that murmuring is the expression of a living being, okay? Therefore, if the soul feels my murmuring flow in all of herself, it is a sign that that soul is all mine. Fascinating, isn't it? So, May 29th, 1905. One who rests in the arms of obedience receives all the divine colours. We would say the divine hues, you know. This morning on coming, blessed Jesus threw himself into my arms as if he wanted to rest. And he said to me, so must the soul rest in the arms of obedience, like a child rests safely in the arms of its mother. That's Psalm 131. My soul is like a weaned child on its mother's lap. And also Psalm 127, verse 2. Psalm 127, verse 2. And one who rests in the arms of obedience receives all the divine colours, because when someone is truly sleeping, one can do to him whatever one wants. In the same way, when someone truly rests in the arms of obedience, it can be said that he is sleeping. You see, Jesus had told her back in volume 1 that she was to act like a dead person in his arms, that he would have complete and total control. That means the will is completely surrendered. But for the rest of most of us, it takes the whole of your life to surrender the will fully. And so God can do what he wants with that particular soul. So May 30th, 1905, the life of love of Jesus. That means Jesus' love really alive in us. Continuing in my usual state, I was saying, Lord, what do you want from me? Manifest your holy will to me. He said, my daughter, I want you all in me. I want all of you. That's your Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 10. 6, 4 to 10. All your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your being. So that I may find everything in you. Just as all creatures had life in my humanity, and I satisfied for all, in the same way, by being all in me, you will make me find all creatures in you. So he wants to reign in this soul and reach out to all creatures through her. That is to say, united with me, you will make me find reparation for all, satisfaction for all, thanksgiving for all, praise for all, and everything that the creatures are obliged to give me within yourself. Now, this is one of our duties as people in the divine will, that we offer him adoration, praise, love, reparation, everything on behalf of all souls, past, present, and future. So we're doing for them what they should be doing themselves, but since they're not doing it out of whatever reason they're not doing it, it means that we have made it possible for those souls to be saved. That's terribly important. It's a bit like you have a person who is really sick and you do for them what they can't do for themselves. And someday they'll be able to get up and they'll be healthy again. Is that okay? So we have to do this for others. And in doing this, we're giving God the glory that is his due on behalf of human beings as well, and filling in all the voids that human beings leave. So in addition to divine life and human life, love administered a third life to me, which made all the lives of creatures germinate within my humanity. Now, we have to take that as he says it. There's no words of ours could actually explain it. Okay. Sometimes people illustrate it today by creating an image of Jesus full of our faces, that each one of us is a little cell of his body. So we're all incorporated into him. Therefore, the mystery of his life and passion and resurrection has got to be in every cell of the body for the body to be completely alive. Does that make sense? I want to give you John 1, 3 to 4. John 1, 3 to 4. And Colossians 1, 15. This is the life of love, because he is love incarnate, now glorified, which while giving me life, gave me continuous death, because he suffered so much on behalf of all those he loved. It beat me, it fortified me, it humiliated me, it raised me, it embittered me, it sweetened me, it tormented me, and it gave me delights. Now, that's the language of a victim soul. That they love God and they love humanity so much that they have to suffer all of this for the sake of bringing humanity to God. What does this life of love not contain? Untiring and ever ready for everything. It contains everything. Everything can be found in it. Its life is ever new and eternal. Oh, how I wish to find this life of love in you, so that as to have you always in me and to find everything in you. You can see from this that the most important thing he can find in us, apart from our surrender to the divine will, is this love. This love must go out to give life to humanity. Okay. That's why the Lord will have you in situations where you have to reach out and love to others, whether you like them or whether you don't, whether you agree with them or whether you don't. What he wants is this love to go out and to give life. You may not actually see it giving life. You may not see any results. But that's not the point, because you're operating on a very high plane. Is that okay? And he lets it seep into humanity as it is required. So that's a very important text there. I would put a VIP on that one. So June the 2nd, 1905. And he's talking about patience. Patience is not something that any of us have naturally, is it? Try an infant and you'll see how much patience they have, which is zero, isn't it? And for the vast majority of the infants that grow up, the patience is still zero. You've got to fight for it, really fight for it. It's not a natural virtue. When we want something, we want it yesterday. Okay, so I want to give you something beautiful. There's a wonderful statement, but here it is in Latin. In patientia vestra, possidebitis animis vestris. I'm sure you've lost your Latin, have you? It's one of the terrifying things that's happened in the church. Because in the Latin, just in one sentence, you can enclose an incredible treasure. In English, it says, in patience you will possess your soul, but it doesn't have the same power at all as the Latin has. Does anybody want it in Latin?
Yes.
So it's in, I-N, and then P-A-T-I-E-N-T-I-A, patientia. In Latin, you pronounce each syllable, okay? Vestra is yours, V-E-S-T-R-A. And the only long word is posidavibus, P-O-S-S-I-D-E-V-I-M-U-S. That is we possess. Animes, A-N-I-M-E-S, is our souls. And vestris is your souls, V-E-S-T-R-I-S, vestris. In patientia vestra, posidavitis animis vestris. Okay. In patience, you will possess your soul. Now, this is why the Lord puts you into situations where you have to develop patience. Okay. And if you want to know what patience is, it's L, 1 mile, O, 1 mile, N, 1 mile, and G, suffering. It's long suffering. It's not something over in 5 minutes. It's not something that's going to be solved in one day. And people living family life get loads of opportunities to take out a PhD in patience. Am I right or am I right? Because all you need is human beings for it. You don't need anything else. And they'll test you, and they'll test you to breaking point. Okay, that's it if it's human beings you're dealing with. You might have different beings down here. But the rest of us have the human ones that would drive you bats. Okay. And the point is, you probably love them all. They still drive you crazy. Okay. My mother used to say she needed the patience of Job dealing with us. Yeah. But I think she needed more than Job, to be honest. June the 2nd, 1905. This morning on coming, Blessed Jesus told me, my daughter, patience is the nourishment of perseverance. In fact, patience keeps passions in their place and strengthens all the virtues. And by receiving from patience the attitude of continuous life, the virtues do not feel the tiredness that inconstancy produces. Now, when you get into the tiredness of inconstancy, it means you give up and you blow your top. Not staying around here anymore, and blah, blah, blah. You know. I was told by a mother that her 6-year-old son decided he was leaving home. He'd had enough, you see. And being a little older than he was, she waited until he walked down the front and she said, by the way, did you bring your pyjamas? Now, that complicated things a little bit. And then she said to him, you know that out there they'll treat you as an adult. He said, what's that got to do with anything? She said, well, they'll only give you food if you buy it. Do you have money? And she went on like that, very gently, until he realised it was too complicated to leave home. He would actually put up with home, where the food and the clothes and stuff were free and the bed was free and everything. She just told him what it would cost. He was only 6. Wasn't that a wise mother? She just told him what it would cost to live out there. You could make the mistake of giving out to the child and telling them to obey you and all the rest of it. She actually won him to actually choose home, no matter how bad it was. It's fascinating. So inconstancy means you stop. And so the impatience takes over. And impatience does not make you feel good, does it?
No.
You feel awful after it. So the soul does not lose heart if she is mortified or humiliated. The patience enables you to keep the mouth shut. Now, the measure of wisdom is your ability and your knowledge in knowing when not to open the mouth. Sometimes it's great wisdom to say nout, okay? Because that calms down other frayed nerves. okay, and brings peace into a situation that could have ended up in war, okay? I want to give you Romans 5:3. Because patience immediately administers to her the necessary nourishment and forms in her a stronger and more stable bond of perseverance. Nor does she push herself too much if this is if she is consoled and elevated, because as patience nourishes perseverance, she contains herself within moderation without going out of its boundaries. Now, patience is a great one for moderation. It doesn't go over the top or under the bottom. It stays in the middle. And as you know, in difficult situations, staying calm in the middle is actually quite difficult. Instead of deciding that you're giving somebody a piece of your mind, which is a very Irish expression, that's definitely not somebody taking out a PhD in patience. Okay. In addition to this, since patience is nourishment, now notice he keeps on saying that it is nourishment. This is the third time it has been said. And as long as one nourishes himself, it can be said that he has life and he is not dead. In the same way, as long as she has patience, the soul will enjoy the life of perseverance. That's very interesting. He has really tied the patience and the perseverance together. Okay, he's really tied them. So he's saying you won't have one without the other. So I want to give you some scriptures for that. 1 Thessalonians 1:3. Hebrews 6:12. James 1:4. Revelation 14:12. Now, they won't be the only references to patience, but whenever you come across something like this, I just give you three or four and leave it at that. Okay. So we come back to crosses in June the 5th, 1905, and they're called baptismal founts. That's very interesting. That a baptismal fount brings you to a completely new life, doesn't it? Okay. So this morning on coming, Blessed Jesus told me, my daughter, crosses, mortifications are as many baptismal fonts. And any kind of cross which is dipped in the thought of my passion loses half its bitterness. Very important statement. Put a colour on it, VIP on it. In other words, the moment we remember the passion of Jesus, we won't react wrongly to what it is that's coming to us. And its weight decreases by half. That's terribly important when we're going through a difficult time, that the weight isn't such that it actually pulls you down. And Jesus says the way to have the weight of a cross not actually pull you down is to keep remembering the passion of Jesus. And he disappeared like a flash. Louisa said, I remained there doing certain adorations and reparations in my interior. And he came back saying, what is not my consolation in seeing redone in you what my humanity did many centuries ago? Now, what Louisa is doing is reparation for others. And he redid all actions and thoughts and words and everything of human beings when he was alive. In fact, everything which I established for each soul to do was done in my humanity beforehand. Now just think of that for a moment, that anything that is asked of you or me has already been done by Jesus, and therefore if we turn to him, he has already got the merits and the grace that we need to manage this. Is that okay? Talk about not being on your own. It's really incredible that he has done it for you. So that's a bit like a mother wanting a child to do something, but the mother has already done it. And so the child only has to step in and do their little bit of stepping in. And the mother, in her wisdom, doesn't actually tell the child, look, I did it, you know. And so whatever the action is, that the child is allowed the bit of participation. So that's what he's telling us, that everything is done ahead of time. And if the soul corresponds to me, what I did for her, she does again within herself. Now, when we do again within ourselves what he has done for us, we are putting our signature on our redemption. We're saying, yes, I agree that you did this for me. When we put our I love you on the whole of the universe, we are putting our signature on the creation and saying, yes, Creator, I agree to creation and I enter into your will and I say yes with you in your fiat and you participate in creation. Now, he did it, but it's a bit like getting the child to try and make some scones as well, and you've done most of the work, but the child puts their hand around it, you know what I mean, and does their little bit of participation. It's one of the things I loved when I went to Africa first. It really struck me back in the 1960s, seeing a mother holding a newborn in her arms. And, you know, they make a kind of stew for dinner. And everybody must stir the stew. Absolutely everybody. Non-participation is not accepted in African families. And I watched her take the newborn. Now, the child might have been 2 or 3 days old, okay. And she took the child's hand and she put a tiny spoon into the child's hand and lifted the child down, and the two of them together, that child stirred the pot once. 2 or 3 days old, I participate. So the Lord wants us to participate in creation, participate in redemption, participate in sanctification. But we're the infant that he's holding, and if he wasn't holding our hands, we couldn't stir the pot. That's why I give you that image to help you to understand it. So June the 23rd, 1905, one who is united with the humanity of Jesus finds herself at the door of his divinity. Now, this is very important because right from the beginning of the life of the church, everything has been through him, with him, and in him. Okay. In other words, the church has lived through the humanity of Jesus. And each one of us must enter into that as we enter personally into this whole redemption and spiritual life. But he says that you're at the door of the divinity, and he wants to bring us that step so that we live in his divinity. That's the privilege for our age. Okay. So this is volume 6, and it's a little introduction to the full revelation of divine will in volumes 11 and 12. So continuing in my usual state, Louisa said, I was thinking of how Jesus Christ died, and that in no way could he fear death. How could he, since he's God? Okay. Because being so united with the divinity, or rather transmuted into it, he was already safe, like someone in his own palace. But for the soul, how different it is. While I was thinking of this and other nonsense, Blessed Jesus said, my daughter, one who is united with my humanity already finds herself at the door of my divinity, because my humanity is a mirror for the soul, from which the divinity is reflected in her. If one is in the reflections of this mirror, it is natural that all of her being be transmuted into love. Beside that, I want you to put 2 Corinthians 3:18. The more you contemplate God, the more you are transformed into the image that you contemplate. Okay. So that's 2 Corinthians 3:18. Because, my daughter, everything that comes out of the human creature, even the movements of her eyes, her lips, the movement of her thoughts and all the rest, everything should be love, done out of love. And since my being is all love, wherever I find love, I absorb everything within myself. Now, there's your Ephesians 3, 16 to 21. 1 John 4, 7. John 34. No, sorry. John 13. John 13, verses 34 and 35. We are to love the way Jesus loved. And there's lots more. Okay. Now, notice that if you reach love, you reach the divinity. Why? Because God is love. If we're trying to do acts in the divine will and we're just keeping rules and regulations and we never really shift into love, we're still at a distance because God is love. Is that okay? So one of the signs that we are moving in the divine will is that love is manifestly growing in us and that love becomes the center of our being. Love is the motivation for everything. The one of the 12 apostles who made more progress than the other 11 was John, the one who loved Jesus the most, the one who understood him the most because he was the lover. I'd be careful in saying that because nowadays they'll misunderstand it. Okay. He is the one through whose spiritual life was all through love. Saint Therese of Lisieux, her spiritual life was entirely through love. Okay, all her motivation was love. I think in her very short story of the soul, she mentions loving Jesus about 315 times, which is quite extraordinary in a very small book. Okay. So the ones who love are the ones who get there much faster. Now, in twice as we go into higher volumes than this, Jesus will tell Louisa that he wants to introduce her to somebody special. And what he does is he brings Aloysius Gonzaga out of heaven to meet Louisa. And he does it twice. And Aloysius Gonzaga was a novice in the Jesuit community in Rome. And he died from a plague that was he was helping all the victims. He was only 19. And Jesus twice brings Aloysius to meet Louisa and says, "This one resembles me more than most of the saints because every breath of his being was love." Isn't that incredible? So that's what I want to illustrate it here. Every breath of his being was love. So it was love for God and love for his neighbour, and that's how he died contracting the disease. So July the 3rd, declarations of Jesus regarding the state of Louisa. So this is July 3, 1905. "Continuing in my usual state, I found myself outside of myself and I found the Queen Mother with baby Jesus in her arms, giving him her most sweet milk. On seeing that the baby was suckling milk from the breast of our mother, I removed him very gently from her breast and I began to suckle myself." I don't know what your reaction to that is. Mine is cheeky. Okay. She's nothing if she isn't brave, this lady. Okay. "On seeing me do this, both of them smiled at my foxiness. But they let me do it. And then after this, the Queen Mother told me, 'Take your pretty little one and enjoy him.' And Louisa took him in her arms. In the meantime, noises of weapons could be heard from outside. And he said to me, 'This government will fall.'" Because you see, whenever anybody has a really close relationship with the Lord, he turns them into a prophet. That's Amos 3:7. The Lord never does anything without telling the prophets first. Okay. "This government will fall," he said. And Louisa said, "When?" And touching the tip of his finger, he added, "Just another fingertip." And Louisa said, "Who knows how long this fingertip is with you?" But he did not pay attention to me. And since I was not really interested in knowing it, I said, "How I wished to know the will of God with regard to me." Now notice he was trying to warn her about something that was going to happen in the country. And because she was after something she wanted to know herself, she just dismissed it. We all give this selective kind of hearing, don't we? Not only to God, but to everybody else as well. And he told me, "Do you have a piece of paper?" for I myself will write and declare my will about you. I didn't have it, she said. So I went to look for one and gave it to him, and the baby wrote, I declare before heaven and earth that it is my will to have chosen her, that's Louisa, as a victim. That's a victim soul. Now, you'd have to add the word soul because in our modern society, victim has a different meaning. Is that okay? So you'd have to add victim soul. I declare that she made the donation of her soul and her body to me. And since I am her absolute master, whenever I please, I share the pains of my passion with her. And in exchange, I give her access to my divinity. Who said Jesus never wrote anything? Okay. I declare that in this access, she prays to me every day for sinners continuously, and she draws a continuous flow of life for the good of sinners themselves. And he wrote many other things that I don't remember too well, she said. I'd remember every word if it was him, wouldn't you? But she's so used to these dialogues with the Lord, you know. It's amazing. On hearing this, I felt, Louisa said, she felt all confused. And I said, Lord, forgive me if I render myself impertinent. You've already done that, in my opinion. I did not want to know this, what you have written. It's enough for me that you alone know it. What I would like to know is whether it is your will for my state to continue. That is, to continue in this state of victim. He's already told her. And in my mind, I continued, whether it is his will for the confessor to come and call me to obedience, or rather the time I spend with the confessor is only my fantasy. We're on volume 6. The priest coming to release her from her stiffness is the thorn in the side. And so instead of coming clean with the Lord and saying, can we get rid of the priest, she goes on about, what is your will for me? So he told her what his will was. Although he knew what was going on in her head, because he knows everything. Okay. It's what I see here, and what I love to share with others, is the normality of the relationship. He knows what she's going on about, but he answers the question she actually asked. It's very interesting. So since he knows everything, that Psalm 139, you know my thoughts before I think them, you know my words before I speak them. But I didn't want to say it, fearing that I might be wanting to know too much, convincing myself that if one thing is his will, the other must be his will too. She has forgotten that he reads all thoughts, he knows everything. And if he's fully within her, surely he knows absolutely everything. And yet we don't seem to grasp fully what this reality is. So baby Jesus continued to write. That's a bit early for writing when you're a baby, isn't it? I declare that it is my will that you continue in this state and that the confessor come to call you to obedience, as well as the time you spend with him. It is also my will for you to be caught by the fear that your state may not be my will. That's very interesting. So, because this has happened frequently, you'd say, why is she going on about it? It's only in the higher volumes that he will tell her that many of the crises she had were not actually for herself. They were for the generations coming after her, who wouldn't have spiritual directors looking after them, and who might query whether they should go on in the divine will or not. And he says, go on. I'm telling you to go on. Okay? Does that make sense to you? And some of the questions she asks him are for us. Not just these ones, but in other places as well. They're not actually for herself. This fear and doubt purifies you of every slightest effect. The Queen Mother and Jesus blessed me, and I kissed their hands, and I found myself inside of myself. Okay. Now, July the 5th, 1905. The humanity of Jesus is melody for the divinity. Continuing in my usual state, I was continuing my usual interior works and blessed Jesus on coming told me, my daughter, My humanity is a melody for the divinity because all my works formed many keys which formed the most perfect and harmonious melody such as to delight the divine hearing. We would use the word delight, not amuse. We have a different meaning to the word amuse, don't we? Okay. So change that to delight. And the soul who conforms to my operations, internal and external, continues the melody of my very humanity for the divinity. Now, what he's saying is that all his actions and everything that he did is like an incredible orchestra playing with enormous divine harmony before God. And when we enter into that, then we're putting our little keys into this harmony as well and into this orchestra. I think it's in volume 7 that Jesus says that Louisa is a note. Now, if you look at a page of music, one little note doesn't seem awfully important. Another time after she had experienced an enormous grace from him, he told her she was an atom. Now, an atom is so small, you need an electron microscope to actually see it. So the fact that he gives us this enormous grace doesn't mean we're important. It just means this is how he wants to operate in the human race. So getting any fancy ideas about importance destroys the whole thing. So it's my nothingness in his allness. Okay. So July the 18th, 1905. The soul must not open her interior to others, only to the confessor. Now this is for Louisa. She's not to tell anybody else what's going on. She's only to tell the priest. In other words, the church is to have discernment about everything that goes on with Louisa right from the very beginning. Nobody else is to interfere. So this is the Lord protecting a revelation that he is making to the church. As I was in my usual state, Blessed Jesus came for just a little and told me, my daughter, when a confessor manifests to the souls his way of working in their interior, he loses the divine to continue to operate. In other words, if he says to Louisa, well, this is the way I do things, Jesus says, no, I'm not taking that. He has to do it my way. Okay. In the same way, if the soul manifests her interior to others in revealing her secret, her drive will evaporate and she will be left all weakened. That's like saying if you put too much water in the soup, you get more water than soup. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And if this does not happen when she opens herself to the confessor, it's because the power of the sacrament keeps the steam and increases the strength and places the seal on it. In other words, she's got to keep this within the parameters that the Lord actually wants. Okay. Otherwise, the message could be completely diluted. So, July the 20th, 1905, when the soul is not faithful to the will of God, God ceases his designs upon her. You need to put a major NB beside that. Okay, that's huge. If we're not faithful to the divine will, he doesn't waste time with us. He has loads of other people to go to. This morning I was praying for a priest who was infirm, who had been my director, and I was thinking to myself, had he continued my direction, would he be infirm or not? And Blessed Jesus in coming said, my daughter, one who enjoys the goods that are present, who enjoys the goods that are present in a house, certainly those who are in it, and even though someone has been there before, only those who are currently in it can enjoy them. Can you see what he's saying?
Yeah.
If this priest was actually with you on a daily basis, yeah, he participates in everything. But if he has moved away and gone back to his own life, then no, he doesn't. All right. And that's not unusual. That's perfectly normal. If you're living in your own home and others the children have been living with you for a certain number of years, when they go off and make their own homes, they've gone and you continue your own mystery. Does that make sense? And they live their mystery. That's the way it is. For example, as long as a servant remains with his master, the master pays him and allows him to enjoy the goods which are in his house. And when he goes away, he calls another one, pays him, and lets him share the goods. That's what I do. When something is wanted by me and is left by somebody else, I transmit it to another person, giving the other person everything which was destined for the first one. So had this priest continued your direction, given your state of victim, he would have enjoyed the goods pertaining to the state of the one who is currently enjoying you, and therefore he would not have been infirm. Very interesting, isn't it? I just have a few exclamation marks after that. And if the current guide, in spite of his health, does not obtain everything else he wants, it's because he does not do fully what I want. And even though he enjoys some goods, yet there are certain charisms of mine that he doesn't deserve. Ta-da. That's a bit of a reality check, isn't it? In other words, he's not going to waste his time on us. Why should he? He has 7.5 billion just at the present. And then all the ones who went before and all the ones who will come after us. So notice it's up to yourself as to whether you stay close enough to the Lord for him to give you his charisms and to give you his goods. And that the bottom line is that you're in union with the divine will. That's the bottom line. The entire Bible is about the struggle between the human will and the divine will. And it's really, really sad the number of times that the Lord says to the prophets, but I only ever asked you to do my will. I didn't ask you to set up this whole sacrificial system. I didn't ask you to kill all these animals. That's very, very clear in Psalm 50, for example. I didn't ask you to do this. You did this imitating other nations. I only asked you to listen to my voice and to obey my will. Not another thing. That's all. What did they do? Offer him all the sacrifices. Didn't do his will. So here you're being told that if a priest is associated with Louisa, if he wants the benefits that come from that, then he too has to enter into the divine will. He too has to surrender himself. In other words, the conditions are the same for everyone. God deals with everybody right across the board in exactly the same way, regardless of your position in the church. Okay. So I'm going to do one more, and then I'm going to take a break because we need to organise something. All right. So July the 22nd, 1905. God does not look at the work, but at the intensity of love in the working. This needs a huge VIP on it. Huge VIP. In other words, you could be doing some fabulous thing, but if it's devoid of love, God doesn't recognize it because God is love and only recognizes his own stamp. All right? So, I was feeling annoyed, Louisa said, for being unable to make certain mortifications, as it seemed to me that the Lord abhorred me. Very strong language there. And therefore he would not permit me to do them. And blessed Jesus came and told me, my daughter, one who really loves me never gets annoyed about anything. Uh-oh. There's the smack on the hand, isn't it? One who really loves me never gets annoyed about anything, but tries to convert all things into love. Now, please put VIP beside that, will you? Save yourself a lot of trouble. For what reason did you want to mortify yourself? Certainly for love of me. And I say to you, for love of me, mortify yourself. And for love of me, take the reliefs that are given to you as well. In other words, mortification for its own sake is not acceptable. Now, he has told her earlier than this that suffering for its own sake was not acceptable either. Only suffering if God has permitted it for whatever his purposes are in your life. Okay, that is of value. But to bring on suffering yourself, no. Same value as hitting an animal in the field. And so the mortifications are the same. If God wants it, that's fine. So, for love of me, mortify yourself, and for love of me, take the reliefs. You see, I would have told you back in volume one that the Louisa had such an intense life and in such a confined situation that if there wasn't balance in the life, she couldn't have survived mentally. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So he says you can't be mortifying yourself all the time. The human nature can't take that. So you do it sometimes and you have relief. You're not on retreat all the time. You can't do that. You have to have other things. You know, and you if you never have holidays, life is pretty awful, isn't it? Okay. The balance is actually terribly important. And the church has taught from the very beginning, virtus in medio stat. That's two bits of Latin you get in one day. Virtue walks the middle road. And the people who have reached very high degrees of holiness had balance in their lives. So the saint who is prepared to mortify themselves is the same one who will enjoy a meal if you invite them to. There's the balance. And who is the model? Jesus. Jesus would starve himself in the wilderness for 6 weeks and he'd go to every invitation that was given to him as well. Why? Because he was loving God and his neighbour. So it's not mortification for its own sake. And that's very important. So for love of me, mortify yourself, and for love of me, take the reliefs. For both one and the other will have the same weight before me. Underline that in green, white and gold. Both of them, whether you're mortifying or taking relief, has the same value in his mind. The value is that if you do one or the other in God's will, that's the value. The weight of any action, be it even an indifferent one, increases according to the dose of love that it contains. So mortifying ourselves just for the sake of it hasn't got much value. It's for love of God and for love of our neighbour to win souls. That's different. Because I do not look at the work, but at the intensity of love that the working contains. Therefore, I want no annoyance in you and always peace. Because in annoyances and in disturbances, it's always the love of self that wants to come out and reign, and the enemy wants to do harm. Doesn't it? The amazing thing is, even when you're up at this height, you still have this problem. But then if you look at the climbers at the third level on Mount Everest, they have lots of problems up there. That's why many of them don't persevere. It doesn't mean that you're, when you're the Olympic gold winner, that you haven't got any problems. It just means that you've managed to persevere to the end. So we're going to stop there at the moment.